Welcome to the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church. We hope our broadcast will bless you.
Does anybody know what this building is? It's bridged by at 2,684 feet and 160 floors. It's the tallest man-made structure ever built. Construction began in September 2004 and was completed this September 2009. Actually, that was when it was scheduled to be completed. I didn't really check to see if it has been, but it's probably pretty close if it hasn't. 5 years of construction and $4.1 billion yielded 3,595,100 square feet of floor area and the new world record. On the screen now is a comparison chart of how it stacks up with some of the other world's taller buildings. Perhaps the most well-known to us is Chicago's Sears Tower, or the Willis Tower, as it was renamed in July. Burj Dubai stands over 1,000 feet taller. Here's a neat picture taken from above the tower sometime during the construction. You can sort of see the curvature out at the edge of the picture, that's just the distortion due to the camera lens. Some on the internet would have you believe it's the curvature of the earth, but that's not true. How'd you like to be one of those, I don't know if you can see those guys up at the top, but how'd you like to be one of those guys up at the top working? I don't care what kind of harness you put on me, I wouldn't be up there. Here's a few interesting facts about the construction of this great tower. 300,000 cubic yards of concrete were used in its construction. You know how much concrete that is? Well, to give you a sense of how much, if you were to use 300,000 cubic yards of concrete to build a sidewalk, your sidewalk would be about 1,200 miles long. And within all this concrete, there's 31,400 metric tons of steel rebar. If laid end to end, the rebar would stretch over a quarter of the way around the world. Now, the concrete and rebar are parts of the building that you don't see in these pictures. But what about the glass and metal panels? About 20.7 acres of glass and 6.8 acres of metal panel comprise the exterior skin of this building. Now, I know 20.7 acres doesn't sound like much to Larry or Greg if we're talking about farmland, but 20 acres is a lot of glass and a lot of windows. The Bible tells us a story about another tower built in the land of Shinar. We don't know how much material was used or even how high it was or was planned to be. But we do, however, know it was constructed of masonry, which would indicate that it was no skyscraper. It wasn't until the introduction of steel-framed construction that man could conceive of skyscrapers as we know them today. Most archaeologists believe it was located in Mesopotamian Babylon, in this region, southwest of Baghdad, Iraq. But as with many archaeological claims, this one's not unanimous. There's a British archaeologist named Michael Saunders, who believes that it was actually constructed in the Pontus region of Turkey, which coincidentally is the same place that many modern academics place the origin of all modern languages. But regardless of its exact location, it's interesting to note that relative to the scale of the world, it's incredibly close to the modern-day location of Burj Dubai. I was going to try to point this out on the map, but here's the Pontus region of Turkey, if you can see my little arrow. And here's the Mesopotamian Babylon, and the Burj Dubai would be in this area. Aside from its location, though, there are very few similarities between the Tower of Babel and the Burj Dubai. One humorous one I read about while I was doing my research was the inabilities of workers to communicate. When the Burj Dubai started to get really high, the construction workers discovered one problem that seems obvious now. Their walkie-talkie stopped working as they climbed the structure. The reason was simple, distance. At the beginning of the construction, they used walkie-talkies that were lightweight and durable and had a long battery life. But as it turned out, there was unanticipated range limitations as they ascended the tower. The similarity stopped there, though, and with technology upgrades, unlike the men of Babel, they were able to overcome their communication problem. It's likely that the Tower of Babel was a ziggurat. This is not the Tower of Babel, of course. This is another ziggurat. A ziggurat is descriptively referred to as a step pyramid. They were made of sun-baked bricks, and at the core, sun-baked bricks at the core, and with facings of fired brick on the outside. And it was a type of architecture that was usually reserved for temple construction. Which raises the question in my mind, was the Tower of Babel a temple of false worship? But let's read the whole account here in Genesis 11, 1 through 9. I put the scriptures on the screen to save some time. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. Can you see? I'm losing part of it, aren't I? No, we'll do our best. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone and they used tar for mortar. They said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise we'll be scattered abroad over the face of the earth, the whole earth." The Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the sons of men had built. The Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language, and this is what they began to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down, and let us go down there and confuse their language, so that they will not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because the Lord confused their language, the language of the whole earth. And from there, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. The story here told in Genesis 11 of the Tower of Babel may, to the casual reader, raise some questions about God's fairness. After all, why did he care if they built a tower? Why didn't he want them to succeed at their plans? Was God afraid that they might actually reach heaven with their tower? Or is God a control freak, ready and willing to step in and mess things up when they're not going his way? Or is there more to this than first meets the eye? Let's break it down a little. In verse 4, it says, let us build for ourselves a city. Now, what's wrong with that? Is there anything inherently wrong with building a city? Before you answer, remember that Jesus went back to heaven to build a city for us. It's called the New Jerusalem, or the Holy City. If Jesus builds cities, it must be an okay activity, right? Well, let's look back a couple of chapters to Genesis 9, verse 1. This is right after Noah and his family got off the ark. And it says, "And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth.'" This was a command, right? Who are the people of Babel we've been reading about in chapter 11? They were the early descendants of Noah. We see here that God has commanded them to do what? To fill the earth, right? Building a city was in direct opposition to God's command. You may say, well, yeah, a lot of time has passed, though, between chapters 9 and 11. Noah and his sons have since died. And these people, they don't know anything about this command to go fill the earth. But then I would question, why the tower? Could it be that they knew they were disobedient to God's command? and as a result, they felt vulnerable to his judgment, failing to trust in the promise that he made to their fathers in chapter 9, verse 11, which says, I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off from the water of the flood, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. They embarked on constructing a tower in part for protection from the erroneous floodwaters, future floodwaters. When we experience guilt from the wrongdoing in our lives, we have a choice. We can choose to repent of our sins and come running back to our Father's open arms, or we can choose to turn from the convicting truth of God and from the God from whom it originates. These early descendants of Noah chose the latter and felt compelled to attempt to protect themselves from the one they should have run to. It's interesting to know that had they followed God's command in Genesis 9:1 to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, they would have effectively avoided many of the pitfalls inherent with city dwelling. Those of you that were involved in coming to prayer meeting last year would remember that we read the book Last Day Events. And in there, one of the chapters that we studied was about the pitfalls of cities. And it talked about how when people are piled up in cities, there's a tendency to lose touch with the natural world which God created for us to learn of his ways, and how the clutter of man blocks out the beauty of creation, encouraging us in the ways of laziness, selfishness, and pleasure-seeking. Had the men of Babel made the correct choice, following God's command by spreading out over the entire earth in homesteads rather than cities, they would have had a better opportunity to hear their speaker or their creator speaking to them through his creation. The tower was a declaration of their self-sufficiency, a bold statement of not only, we don't need you, God, but also, this time, you can't get us. Direct, open defiance. Let's just pretend for a moment that the children that you have raised or that we're currently raising are not perfect. I know that might be a stretch for some, but it's hypothetical. Stay with me. Now imagine that your child is playing with his favorite toy. He's in the other room, and you need something from him. You need him to come and help you with something, so you call his name. Instead of responding how you would expect, by stopping his play and running to you, he continues to play with the toys as if you hadn't said anything. That's disobedience, right? Now picture the same scenario, but this time, seeing no response to your call, you walk towards your child with the intention of pointing out his error. As you approach, he jumps up and shouts, "No, and you can't get me," and proceeds to run away from you. Is this behavior still disobedience? I would propose that it goes beyond disobedience and would classify it as defiance. Which behavior would make you more concerned about the character development of your child? Of course, the defiance would. I'm not trying to minimize the importance of obedience, but defiance seems to be a much more grievous offense. And this was one of the sins of the inhabitants of Babel. And looking at it in this light, it's not hard to see why God felt it necessary to intervene. A little further down in Genesis 11, we read, "And let us make for ourselves a name." Here we find another sin of the people of Babel. They'd become impressed with themselves. Instead of seeking to glorify God in his attributes, drawing others to him, they wanted to lift themselves up to a place of importance and receive the praise and glory that rightly belong to God. This sounds all too similar to the description in Isaiah 14:12-14 that we read about Satan. "How you have fallen from the heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down from the earth. You who have weakened the nations, but you said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north." And I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will make myself like the Most High. What about us, you and me? We certainly don't say these words audibly, but do our thoughts and our plans, our actions, speak these words? When someone at the office pats you on the shoulder after an impressive performance with a client and says, "Good job, I never would have thought of that approach," do we enjoy the praise a little too much? Or when you're sitting in class, if you're a student, if you're sitting in class after receiving your test results, do you find, and you find it was your score that established the curve, the top part of the curve, do you look down your nose a little bit at your fellow students feeling intellectually superior? As many, if not all of you know, I had a job change recently. After realizing the company that I had been working for 15 years, 15 plus years, was going out of business, I applied for, interviewed, and secured a position at Delta College. Through the process that I went through, I experienced some things that helped me identify this prideful attitude in myself. First of all, after realizing that when discussing my job, with others and the fact that it was ending, it was important to me to make clear that I wasn't losing my job as a result of a layoff or a termination, but it was because the company was going out of business. I didn't want anyone to think that I wasn't valuable to my employer. That's pride. Then after securing the job, I found myself easily falling into the trap of accepting the praise of others for landing the job based on my own qualifications, credentials, and experience. Pride again. And finally, although I really honestly hoped that my coworkers would find employment too, I must admit I felt a certain victory in being the first one to find something. It's important that we recognize these manifestations of pride and humble ourselves and repent of them. Heeding the wise words of Solomon in Proverbs 29:23, "A man's pride will bring him low, but a humble spirit will obtain honor." We must be careful with pride because it is often subtle at first, but if nurtured, will grow and lead to our ultimate destruction. I remember, I don't know how many years ago now, when I first heard the word narcissism. Most of you might know what narcissism is, but I had never studied psychology in school. Sociology was the closest that you got in architecture school, at least at that time. So it was only about, maybe 4 or 5 years ago that I heard it defined. Simply stated, narcissism is a psychological condition characterized by self-preoccupation, lack of empathy, and unconscious deficits in self-esteem. After hearing this and thinking about it, I started to question myself, am I narcissistic? I'm always looking out for myself. Oftentimes my thoughts are consumed with my own plans. Sometimes I'm annoyed with more than compassionate towards other people. So the list of my prideful and selfish behaviors began to build in my mind. And like the healthy man who begins to find symptoms of a disease in himself after reading about it, I quickly diagnosed myself with terminal narcissism. There's probably a word to describe this behavior as well. I heard it referred to as medical student syndrome once. With time, though, my rational mind took back over, and I realized the condition of narcissism was probably more acute than my condition, which could be more accurately characterized as sinful man. But this exercise in self-psychoanalysis helped me to recognize my pride and ego that I had. The Tower of Babel is not the only biblical example, though, of God intervening in the affairs of man to root out the evils of pride. The Old Testament is full of examples of God stepping in and punishing Israel and Judah for the pride of the people and their kings. It was Judah's pride that led to the betrayal of Christ and Peter to denying him. There was Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4, 30 and 31 we read about. The king said, is not this the great Babylon that I have built, the royal residence and seat of government? By the might of my power and for the honor and glory of my majesty? While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. Nebuchadnezzar lost his mind and was made to live with the beasts of the field for 7 years as a result of his pride. And then there's the one we mentioned earlier who started this whole business. And we'll read in Ezekiel, read about him in Ezekiel 28:12-19. You are the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. The sardis, topaz, and diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. You are the anointed cherub that covers. I established you. You are on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. Sorry. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your own wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that might gaze at you. You defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities, by the iniquity of your trading. Therefore, I brought fire from the midst of it and devoured you. And I turned you to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all who saw you. And all who knew you among the peoples are astonished at you and have become a horror. You have become a horror and shall be no more forever. Pride is something to take seriously, isn't it? I think so. How many here went to the Michigan Men of Faith Conference in September last month? All right, no ladies raised their hand. That's good. Doug Batcher spoke there, and he spoke in the afternoon about this very topic of pride. He said a few things that I scribbled down because I was preparing the sermon and partly because I thought they were interesting. But he made two statements that I want to mention. The first was, pride springs forth from selfishness. It's true, right? Have you ever met a prideful person that's always thinking of others first? Of course not. A selfless person cannot be proud because their focus is not on themselves. The second statement was, the antithesis of selfishness is love. Selfishness and love are opposites. The Bible tells us plainly that God is love. The Bible tells us also that love is his character. Would it also be accurate to say the character of Satan is selfishness? Whose character do you desire this morning? God's, right? Well, how can we develop a character like God's or Christ's? The Bible seems to indicate that humility has an important role to play. Let's look together at 1 Peter 5:5-6. Likewise, you who are younger and of lesser rank, be subject to the elders. Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility towards one another. For God sets himself up against the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that in due time he may exalt you. And Micah 6:8 says, he has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love kindness and mercy, and to humble yourself and walk humbly with God. So humility has more to it than just being lowly. We see here It's associated with love, kindness, and mercy. These are all virtues of God that we too can possess. Peter spoke of humility towards one another. How can we show humility towards one another? By caring for others, putting their needs before ours? Let's read what Jesus had to say in Luke 14:11-14. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Jesus also said to the man who had invited him, when you give a dinner or supper, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your wealthy neighbors, lest perhaps they also invite you in return, and so you are paid back. But when you give a banquet or reception, invite the poor, the disabled, the lame, the blind. Then you will be blessed, because they have no way of repaying you, and you will be recompensated at the resurrection of the just. Jesus didn't just teach this philosophy of service. He lived it, of course. In the life of Christ, we see the epitome of humility. He entered our world as an infant in a blue-collar family, made disciples of uneducated fishermen, ministered to lepers and prostitutes and tax collectors, yet somehow he captured the attention of the world. Jesus tells the story of a publican, a Pharisee and a publican. We find it in Luke 18:10-14. It says, two men went up into the temple to pray, the one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee took his stand ostentatiously and began to pray thus before and with himself. God, I thank you that I am not like the rest of men, extortioners, swindlers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector here. I fast twice a week, I give tithes of all that I gain. But the tax collector, standing at a distance, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but kept striking his breast, saying, O God, be favorable to me, the especially wicked sinner that I am. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other man. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. There's a story of two other men, Robin Schmidt and Jan Benrez, dressed as European engineers before the dawn, climbed stairs for an hour and 15 minutes to reach the 160th floor of the Burj Dubai. Filming the entire event, they made history as they hurled themselves off of a balcony to free fall for what seemed like an awfully long time before deploying their parachutes, landing, and speeding off in the getaway car, evading security and the police. The first and possibly only men to base jump the Burj Dubai. Thrill seekers? Yes. But as I watched their YouTube video, I could not help but notice the pride they had in their accomplishment. I found it interesting the words Jan used to describe the moment right before the jump. He said, and I quote, at this point, I'm free. I'm doing what I want to do. No one's there to tell me it's good or it's bad. It's a moment of freedom, of total freedom. That sounds a lot like an unsurrendered heart of sin, doesn't it? I want to be free to do what I want, with nobody telling me what to do. And what is the purpose of a half-mile-high building if not for pride? It's an amazing engineering feat, interesting to read about and inspiring to look at, but not practical. It brings bragging rights and national pride. We're the tallest, the best, the richest, seeking to elevate oneself. Who do we seek to elevate? Now is the judgment of the world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And I, Christ, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself. Pride seeks to elevate oneself. May our pride rest only in our Savior, who overcame the world for us.
You have been listening to the broadcast from the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church at 2420 East Ashman in Midland, Michigan. If you are in the area, we cordially invite you to visit our church Saturday mornings. If you are a distance away, we encourage you to continue visiting our website and weekly podcast at midlandsda.org.